More than a century after his death, the ghost of James Meybrick would rise from his grave in an explosion of furor and excitement that would rock the foundations of many crime historians, lecturers, and most certainly wannabe detectives, all of whom had spent decades trying to uncover the real identity of the world's most notorious murderer, the grandfather of the modern-day serial killer, if you will, that of Jack the Ripper. Back in 1991, a diary was uncovered lying dormant underneath the floorboards of a bedroom within Battle Creek's house, the former home of James and his wife Florence. The room in question was James Meybrick's bedroom, and the place he had spent the last few weeks of his life in excruciating pain, suffering from acute poisoning that would eventually claim his life. But it was whilst Battle Creek's house underwent some renovation work, workmen came across the diary, a leather-bound scrapbook with many pages missing but containing 63 pages of legible writing with around 9,000 written words. The book, or diary as it would later be known as, would soon divide the world of self-proclaimed Ripperologists, experts in all things Jack the Ripper, with many saying it was clearly fake, whilst others sat on the fence, not wanting to ruin their own credentials by quickly calling it out as being fake before knowing the full facts. But 2 years later, and on Friday, April 23rd, 1993, the Liverpool Daily Post would be one of the very first news outlets to become aware of the existence of the diary. Harold Brough, a journalist working for the Daily Post, was quick to run the story and began investigating the origins of the diary, speaking to its owner, Michael Barrett. All hell broke loose, with many other news outlets quickly taking a keen interest in this story, and they all wanted to be the first to identify the man responsible for writing the diary and ultimately revealing the name of the most sought-after serial killer in history. Now, we won't get into how Michael Barrett came into possession of the diary. This information is freely available on the internet, but what we can say for sure is that his story will prove to be suspicious and inconsistent, and one to tread carefully through when trying to weed out fact from fiction. But the diary itself is perhaps one of the most intriguing and possibly most important historical pieces of work to ever be discovered in terms of its importance in solving the most unsolvable puzzles of all time. Who was Jack the Ripper? But for this, we need to delve into the life of James Meybrick. James Meybrick was a well-known and wealthy cotton merchant based in Liverpool during the late 1800s. In 1871, James was unmarried and living in London with his mother. But around 1873, he would go on to form Meybrick & Company Cotton Merchants with his brother Edwin, who would be a junior partner. He then travelled to Norfolk, Virginia in the United States to establish a new branch office where he could expand his business. However, 3 years after arriving in Norfolk, James contracted malaria, and after an initial prescription of quinine failed to offer any help, a second prescription containing arsenic and strychnine was tried. It is believed that it was at this time in James's life that he would become addicted to arsenic, and he also believed it would make him more virile. Indeed, arsenic was seen to be a fashionable pastime for professional men in the United Kingdom during the 19th century. In 1880, James left the United States to return back to England. Travelling back on the SS Baltic, the 6-day voyage would introduce him to 18-year-old Florence Chandler and her mother, Baroness Caroline von Rauchs. Although James was 24 years older than Florence, a romance immediately followed, and astonishingly, by the time they had both arrived in Liverpool, they had already planned to be married, and the following summer, on July 27, 1881, their wedding took place at St James's Church, Piccadilly, in London. 8 months later, Florence would give birth, albeit prematurely, to a son they called James Chandler, and not too long after, the Meybricks relocated back to Norfolk, Virginia. However, Meybrick & Company soon began to face difficulties, and the family moved back to Liverpool in 1884. Residing in Grassdale, a small suburb of Liverpool, James was becoming worried over financial affairs, heaping stress on not only himself, but also that of his wife, Florence. 2 years later, Florence would give birth to a daughter they named Gladys Evelyn, but it appears their marriage was deteriorating at this point, and James was showing signs of substance abuse, something that he had tried to hide from his social circle of affluent friends in and around Liverpool. And by 1888, the Meybricks moved yet again, this time to Battle Creek's house in Aigburth, less than a mile away from Grassendale. It appears they had rented the house, which had included several acres of gardens, trees, and also included a large pond. Perhaps by moving into Battlecreese House, it was more of a statement that tried to prove James's stature within Liverpool. But in reality, the marriage of James and Floris had become unrepairable. James had become withdrawn, but would often have violent outbursts, and his reliance on arsenic had begun to consume him. If we are to believe that the diary is indeed genuine, then what it describes to us is the descent into madness of a man hell-bent on revenge. But why revenge? The diary makes many references to Florence Maybrick having secret liaisons with another man, but whilst his name never appears in any form of text, we now know historically that this man was called Alfred Brierley, a young cotton broker. It seems that Florence was aware that James had, himself, been involved in extramarital affairs during the course of their marriage, and along with the abuse she was receiving at the hands of James, we can only assume she found solace in the arms of another man. What makes this compelling is the fact that James Maybrick found out about Florence's infidelity and flew into an almighty rage, and the diary shows a glimpse into the mind of the writer.
Foolish bitch. I know for certain she has arranged a rendezvous with him in Whitechapel. So be it. My mind is firmly made. I took refreshments at the post house. It was there I finally decided London it shall be. And why not? Is it not an ideal location? Indeed, do I not frequently visit the capital, and indeed do I have a legitimate reason for doing? All who sell their dirty words shall pay. Of that I have no doubt. But shall I pay? I think not. I am too clever for that.
Many references in the diary also refer to Michael Maybrick, the brother of James, and his name appears a total of 25 times, with the majority of times appearing early on. And this is something that we will come back to shortly, as it may prove to be pivotal in trying to understand the true origins of this diary. So this brings us to the autumn of 1888, and to the very beginnings of what has been termed the Autumn of Terror by many authors over the years. The story of Jack the Ripper and the crimes he committed have become somewhat a staple of British Victorian history. It seems everyone has heard the story, or more certainly the name Jack the Ripper. And whilst it's generally accepted that Jack had killed five prostitutes, or known as the canonical five, between August 31st, 1888 and the 9th November 1888, many scholars and researchers believe the total number of women killed may stretch to around 11, if not more. And this is something that the diary itself seems to describe in somewhat macabre detail, beginning with what we believe to be the murder of Mary Ann Nichols, whose body was found lying in Buxraw, Whitechapel on the 31st of August 1888. Her throat had been severed by two deep cuts, her vagina having been stabbed twice and the lower part of her abdomen ripped open in a jagged sort of fashion, causing her bowels to protrude. Now the writer of the diary gloats about this murder.
I have shown all that I mean business. The pleasure was far better than I imagined. The whore was only too willing to do her business. I recall all and it thrills me. There was no scream when I cut. I was more than vexed when the head would not come off. I believe I will need more strength next time. I struck deep into her. I regret I never had the cane. It would have been a delight to have rounded hard into her. The bitch opened like a ripe peach. I have decided next time I will rip all out. My medicine will give me strength, and the thought of the whore and her whoring master will spur me on no end.
Now the writing, seemingly infused with delight, goes on to say,
I will not allow too much time to pass before my next. Indeed, I need to repeat my pleasure as soon as possible. The whoring master can have her with pleasure, and I shall have my pleasure with my thoughts and deeds. I will be clever. I will not call the Michael on my next visit.
At the time of the first murder in Whitechapel, the Maybricks' marriage was in tatters, and it seems plausible that James and Florence were now sleeping in separate bedrooms, and they would do so for the remainder of the now short time he had left before his death later in 1889. James was also well aware of Florence's flirtations with another man, just as the diary indicates, but we do have to question who else may have been aware of Florence's secret rendezvous with Alfred Brierley. James, it seemed, had a very close relationship with both of his brothers, Edwin and Michael, and it is the latter that the diary mentions on quite a few occasions. It appears that James had met Michael numerous times, either in Whitechapel, London, during the time of the Ripper murders, as well as Battlecreese House in Liverpool. I guess, therefore, it is safe to assume that James would have told Michael about his troubles with Florence, as well as mentioning her relationship with Alfred Brierley. And as for Michael Maybrick, he was a successful composer and singer who travelled throughout the United Kingdom, and indeed the world, during the mid to late 1800s. Many of his songs would be written under the pseudonym Stephen Adams, and being an established and experienced writer of songs, Michael had a unique way with words and verses, and this is something we will mention again towards the end of this story. The Whitechapel Murders. If we are to just talk about the non-five canonical victims, or named as the victims of Jack the Ripper, this lasted for a period of 9 weeks, from Friday 31st of August, and beginning with the murder of Mary Ann Nichols, and ending on Friday 9th November 1888, and the death of Mary Jane Kelly. In that 9 week period, the five victims were found brutally slain during the early hours on days that fell on or close to the weekend, which in itself could be a clue as to the travel habits of the killer. The only exception being Mary Jane Kelly, whose body would be found lying on her bed by Thomas Bowyer, who had been sent by his boss later in the morning to collect some rent money. Interestingly, Mary was the only victim to be found murdered indoors. The diary indicates to us that James would often travel to London, and as already mentioned, he would at times meet his brother Michael. However, the writer of the diary never starts any of the entries with a date, so we cannot say for certain if James was indeed in London on those dates when the murders actually took place, and all we can do is try and find clues hidden within the text. If the diary is genuine, then the writer goes into extreme details when describing the murders, but what is strikingly obvious is that he also likes to mock the reader by writing verses such as,
"One dirty whore was looking for some pain, another dirty whore was looking for the same."
And another,
"One ring, two rings, a farthing, one and two, along with M, ha ha, will catch clever Jim, it's true, no pill, left but two."
Now the writer of the diary is consistent throughout, using verse to mock not only the reader, but also those investigating the murders, and it seems Detective Inspector Frederick Aberline was the main target.
"Oh, Mr. Aberline, he's a clever little man. He keeps back all that he can. For do I not know better? Indeed I do. Did I not leave him a very good clue? Nothing is mentioned of this, I am sure. Ask clever Aberline could tell you more."
Aberline's name is mentioned also 25 times in total, many times used in verse, as it seems the writer is somewhat challenging the former detective inspector in a cat and mouse parody. And you also get the sense that the writer himself was feeling somewhat untouchable. You can also see that the writer is certainly at ease when it comes to writing, and especially more so in form that somewhat resembles that of what you would associate with someone who perhaps has a career in theatre, perhaps someone such as Michael Maybrick. This then brings us to question as to who the author of the diary was. Months after the diary's discovery, Mrs. Doreen Montgomery of Rupert Crewe Limited, one of London's best known agencies, contacted author Shirley Harrison, inviting her to London to see the diary being presented by Michael Barrett, who was hoping to have it published. This then saw the diary and its contents undergo extensive research and examinations, leading Shirley and her team to conclude that it was written by James Maybrick. The handwritten entries seemingly pointed to proof that Jack the Ripper was indeed the wealthy cotton merchant from Liverpool and who had sought revenge for his wife's infidelity. But is this really the case? Other than pages sprawled with information that was already in the public domain during the time of the Ripper murders, does the diary have enough evidence to convict James Maybrick of murder? People will point to the fact as it was discovered under the floorboards of the bedroom James Maybrick once used, then surely it must have been written by him. But let's dig a little deeper and turn everything that we have been told around and point the finger of suspicion to the one person whom James had a good relationship and with someone who he had spent a lot of time with whilst in London, that of Michael Maybrick, his brother. There is a wonderful book called They All Love Jack, Busting the Ripper, that was released back in September 2015, and it was written by Bruce Robinson. The book is a massive 864 pages thick, contains a wealth of information that took over 12 years to put together, but in it, a name is added to the many of Jack the Ripper's suspects. But why would Michael not only begin a killing spree, but also want to eventually put the blame onto his brother James? In the case of Michael, He had a deep hatred in women, that is a fact. He detested everything they stood for, and it seems the poorest and those working the streets angered him even more. But it was the woman James Maybrick was married to that seemed to be the focal centre of all his hatred, that of Florence Maybrick. It has been written that Michael preferred being in the company of men, spending more time in male company than that of females, and yet despite this, he is still married to a lady called Laura Withers on the 9th of March 1893. She had been his housekeeper for some time, but it has been documented that even though he was married, he would still never be seen out in the company of his wife, and on the odd occurrence when they were seen together, he would often walk behind the carriage she was travelling in, as he couldn't stand sitting next to her. As for placing the blame of the atrocities that took place in the autumn of 1888 onto his brother, why would Michael do this? For this, we have to look into the Freemasons during the Victorian era. We know that both James and Michael were themselves eminent Freemasons, so it's quite plausible that Michael, worried about his status within the organisation should his little secrets ever be exposed, tried to cover his tracks and so began a campaign to discredit his brother. The interesting thing behind this theory, and that's all it is that no one can place an exact date as to when the diary was actually written. Now, whilst tests on the ink used and the type of paper that is bound inside the leather cover seemingly dates back to the late 1800s or early 1900s, when it was actually written cannot be certified. So with this in mind, surely it's within the realms of possibility that it may have been written after the death of James, and therefore Michael perhaps wouldn't be feeling as guilty in bringing his brother's name into jeopardy as he may have done so if James had been alive. The last known, or the last of the canonical victims to be murdered, occurred on Friday 9th November 1888. And whilst there may well be more victims associated to Jack the Ripper, we will never be sure. But there is and always has been a lingering question as to why the killings suddenly stopped. The truth, however, couldn't be further away. Michael Maybrick was well known for travelling around the United Kingdom, as we have already mentioned, and he would often be seen in Manchester one evening, followed by possible trips to Newcastle, Sunderland and Bradford. Interestingly, a truly horrific murder did indeed take place in Bradford on Thursday, December 29th, 1888, when the body of a 7-year-old boy named John Gill was discovered badly mutilated. The South Wales Echo newspaper reported the injuries in truly horrific detail. The unfortunate victim had been indescribably mutilated. Both legs were cut off close to the body. The abdomen was slightly open and the intestines partly extracted. Both ears were cut off and there were other shocking disfigurements. When found, the limbs were tied to the body. The braces which the deceased had worn were used to bind the limbs to the trunk. The clothes of the boy were then wrapped around the body, the jacket enveloping the parcel. There was a sack found with the body with the name W. Mason, Derby Road, Liverpool, printed upon it, and this the police hope will serve as a clue to the perpetrators of the crime. Now, when you read this, you automatically think of the savage butchery and mutilation of Mary Jane Kelly, who was the last victim of the canonical five. So you have to ask yourself, how many other people were killed by Jack the Ripper, and in what areas did they occur within? And if we imagine for one moment that Michael Maybrick was the Ripper, then he would certainly be in the right location at the same time as the John Gill murder. This is something factually correct, as he was appearing in Bradford just days before the discovery of Gill's body. It appears that Jack also liked to leave clues at the scene of his murders, and again, the diary gives us reason to delve deeper into each case. For example, the writer of the diary claims he left his mark during one outrage. The thrill she gave me was unlike the others. I cut deep, deep. Her nose annoyed me, so I cut it off. Had a go at her eyes. Left my mark. Could not get the bitch's head off. I believe now it is impossible to do so. The whore never screamed. Now, Catherine Eddowes was the fourth victim of Jack, and amongst the many injuries and cuts to her body, two inverted V's are thought to have been purposely cut beneath each eye. And when placed side by side, this would show the letter M. Many people assume that this is a subtle clue left by James Maybrick, but what if everything we have ever read on this subject is wrong, and the inverted V's are indeed meant to refer to Michael? And then there is the photograph of the body of Mary Jane Kelly and the so-called letter M that can be seen amongst the blood splatter on the wall. Another reference to Michael, perhaps, or are we just seeing what we want to see? James Maybrick's health took a turn for the worse during the latter parts of 1888, and on the 27th of April 1889 he was taken ill after administering to himself a double dose of strychnine. His reliance on medicines that included the use of arsenic would soon lead to his death. Shortly after, and on the 8th of May, James's wife Florence wrote a letter to Alfred Brierly, but this was intercepted by Alice Yapp, one of the maids at Battle Creese House. This letter was then handed over to Edwin Maybrick along with many others Yapp had been asked to post. Edwin would then pass some, if not all of these letters, to Michael. Now, with James in a serious condition, Michael had returned from London and was soon to become, we believe, the head of the house. And most importantly, as we have already discussed, he had a hatred for Florence, perhaps because of her infidelity towards James. And on May 9th, and after another maid had made an accusation towards Florence, saying she had seen her tamper with the bottle of Valentine's meat juice that would later be confirmed to have contained half a grain of arsenic, Michael placed Florence under house arrest. James Maybrick died 2 days later, on May 11th, 1889. Florence would soon be arrested and charged with his murder, something which she would later deny in court, and the real story of Florence Maybrick is a story we have planned for another day. So what of the diary? Who wrote it? When was it written? Is it a modern hoax? One answer I can say with 100% certainty is that the diary is real. But it is not all it seems to be, and whilst the contents contained within may point to James Maybrick as being Jack the Ripper, we should all tread carefully before making assumptions that what has been written is nothing but the truth. On a personal note, I cannot dismiss Michael as being the man behind the diary. His long career as a well-known singer-songwriter cannot be ignored, as the diary contains plenty of examples of verses that mock not only the reader, but also the police investigators and the press at the time. Michael, after the death of James and with Florence now out of the way and locked up in prison, had all the time in the world to concoct the idea of a diary. Obviously, if he himself was the Ripper, he had all the knowledge required to pen such detail and interweave it with his brother's tales of Florence's infidelity. Using words such as whore and bitch to imply James was full of rage and resentment to his wife, Michael had everything he needed to convince the world of Jack the Ripper's true identity. Now, the last entry into the diary is dated 9th of May 1889, so some will say that if the diary was signed off by James on the 9th of May, then how could Michael have possibly written it? Now, I would argue that at no other time in the diary are any other dates entered, so why should we believe that the final entry was indeed written on the 9th of May? It wouldn't have been difficult to have simply backdated this last entry long after James's death. But let's go back to Michael and his career as a singer-songwriter and to the double event murders that puzzled the police at the time, as well as today's modern-day investigators, the murders of Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes. What has become known as the Gulston Street Graffiti, a sentence was written in chalk on a wall that read, "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing." Again, a rhyme or a verse written by someone, it seems, with a knack of writing, someone perhaps like Michael Maybrick. But what makes this all the more interesting is the wording of Jews, J-U-W-E-S. It has been said that this is a reference to the Freemasons and to Jubella, Jubilo and Jubellum, assassins central to the Masonic Lodge. And if we are led to believe that this is true, it is no surprise as to why it was quickly rubbed off the wall by orders of Sir Charles Warren, who was the Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police during the Ripper murders. He was a senior Mason and knew full well that the word Jews had been written by a fellow Mason, and there would be no way he would allow the Freemasons to be dragged into the murky world of the savage murders. Of course, I'm only putting forward my own theory when it comes to the Freemasons and the link with Michael Maybrick, but it all does seem plausible. Now, if we need an ounce of proof that Michael was extremely well versed in being deceitful, we only need to refer back to press interviews not too long after the Florence Maybrick trial ended in 1889. The Examiner on August 24th, 1889, recorded an interview with Michael, and it's quite telling. "Nothing would please me more now," said Mr. Michael Maybrick when called upon by the Herald's representative, "than to hear that the Home Secretary's decision is that Mrs. Maybrick shall go free." Mr. Maybrick said, "It has been published that I never liked Mrs. Maybrick, that I avoided her house and said once that I never would darken her door again. All this is untrue. My relations with her have always been pleasant. She has come to me time and again for money, and one thing and another, and she always gets it. He also goes on to say, "Since his death, James, my chief desire has been to save his good name for the sake of his children. For their sake, I hope she would not be convicted, and I am now anxious for her release. I have no enmity against her and do not want to be understood as making any charges against her." Also, when asked if he knew that James had used arsenic, Michael replied, "No, I do not. I am sure he didn't, as I am of anything, almost. If he had used it, I would have been certain to know of it. He was not a man to use poison. Besides, he was always very confidential to me, told me everything, and he would have been sure to tell me if he had any habit of that kind." So Michael wants us to believe that he knew nothing of James's addiction to using arsenic, and he had not a bad word to say against Florence. Finally, is the fog that once blanketed the east end of London during those terrifying months of the Ripper's reign now slowly beginning to disperse, and in doing so, perhaps, just perhaps, the face of Jack the Ripper is slowly beginning to reveal itself. Has James Maybrick been wrongly accused of being Jack, or does the diary give us some clues as to the real identity and that of Michael Maybrick? One thing is for sure, despite the many accusations of the diary being a fake, a hoax, it most certainly is a real, physical entity in every sense of the word. And as for the content, we have to treat it with due respect and keep on trying to look at what has been written, reading between the lines. The clues are there, I'm sure of that. We just need to tie them down to real, factual evidence that may or may never be forthcoming. Until then,
I give my name that all know of me, so history do tell. What love can do to a gentleman born. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper.
So many, many thanks for listening to this interesting story. I hope you enjoyed it. It's a story I've always been fascinated in. Who was Jack the Ripper? A lot of what I have read out to you guys is my own opinions. I would love to hear what yours are, so please do comment down below if you're listening to this via our website at daysofhorror.com. Who do you think Jack the Ripper was? James Maybrick, Michael Maybrick, or perhaps one of the many others that have been named throughout time? Again, comment down below. But in the meantime, many thanks for listening. As I always say, take care, look after yourselves, and I'll be back soon with another interesting tale from our past.